It was a 4-day work week, right, for most of us? Felt like 5, 6, maybe. What happened and why? On the program today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 6th day of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This being the first Friday of the month, there is, of course, this morning's jobs report to cover. 130,000 more people employed in August than in July. The rate stayed at 3.7%, all of which is good, or good-ish at the very least. But it comes amid a, shall we say, challenging economic backdrop, the details of which we will get to in the next 6 or so minutes. Anna Swanson covers trade for the New York Times. Neela Richardson is at Edward Jones. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Neela, let me go to you first, actually, as the accredited economist in the crowd. Good-ish job numbers, as I said. What'd you really like out of this thing?
Well, I like that there was enough jobs created to keep the economy moving forward. I also like that average hourly hours worked increased, yeah, and that wages and the pace of wage growth was holding steady. When it comes to this economic expansion, it's all about the consumer. And so higher wage growth and longer hours, that means more consumer spending, and that is really the linchpin of growth going forward.
And just to follow up on that hours worked thing, right? The theory being, mm-hmm, Neela, that if employers are going to start cutting back in jobs, they're going to shorten people's work weeks, right? Is that the deal?
Exactly. That's the first step. You're not going to cut jobs right away. You start with wages. If we're seeing a bit of a rebound, start with hours. If you see a bit of a rebound in hours, that's good news of a stabilizing picture going forward. We saw a decline last month. The fact that it increased this month is a good sign.
Gotcha. All right. Anna Swanson, let me get to you and the challenging economic backdrop, shall we say. I'm obliged to note here, mm-hmm, that tariffs went up this past Sunday, as the president had promised. There was movement this week, I suppose, in the trade war, right? They said, we're going to have some talks, but it does seem, a step and a half forward, a step and a half back-ish.
Yeah, that's right. So markets really greeted that news that there would be talks and have ended the week on a more positive note. But meanwhile, more and more tariffs continue to be added. The United States now has the highest tariff rate since the 1960s. And it's looking, less and less likely that the United States and China can totally de-escalate the tensions and come to more of a transformative trade deal. There is some possibility that you could see President Trump and President Xi from China get into a room and agree that China is going to buy some agricultural products, something that would kind of smooth things over, and the markets might react positively to that. But the farther we go down this road with the president imposing more tariffs, a trade deal that would really kind of resolve tensions between the two countries in a lasting sense looks harder to achieve.
So, Anna, I get a hard time on Friday afternoons from my conservative friends when I say this, but the president has kind of painted himself into a corner, right? He desperately needs a deal for his own political election purposes, but the deal that he wants is excruciatingly difficult to make.
I think there are kind of downsides in either direction potentially here. And he is really just hoping that this strategy of ramping up tariffs on China is going to work. The administration seems really cognizant of challenges from Democrats who could potentially, mm-hmm, call him weak on China, really aware of figures like Chuck Schumer, for example, who has actually agreed with the president on a lot of these China policies on being tough on China. And, aware that if he settles for the kind of provisions that China is offering right now, he opens himself up to easier criticism on the campaign trail.
Right. Neela, let me touch on something we did on the program, I guess maybe the other day, talking about, aside from the trade war and the global slowing, which we have discussed, the economic fundamentals in the United States are really pretty okay.
Pretty okay. But one thing that the Fed is completely attuned to is this idea of too low inflation.
Yeah.
Usually when we think of inflation being a problem, we think of too high inflation that causes the Fed to jump in and hike interest rates and then choke off economic growth. We're actually seeing the opposite, too low inflation. That's why the markets want a cut. That's what's being used to justify a rate cut. But underlying all of that is really the global picture uncertainty. Trade and the global slowdown is affecting the Fed as much as the inflation picture is.
Jay Powell, speaking of which, Anna, gave a presentation, I guess it wasn't a speech, it was a Q&A thing over in Zurich today, right, in which he said all the appropriate things that Fed chairs say, you know, data-dependent, non-political. I imagine he's just kind of looking at this jobs report today and the trade war going, I don't know. Right.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a mixed picture, as Nila was saying. You know, it did have some bright spots, but there was an, you know, unmistakable kind of picture of an economic slowdown there. And I think, you know, the jobs report does strengthen the case for a rate cut, although probably just a quarter point rather than a half coming up here. And that's what Jay Powell indicated today in Zurich as well. The jobs report wasn't necessarily, you know, flashing signs of a recession, but I do think there are some worrying signs as well. I mean, there are some signs that this global manufacturing slowdown that we've been seeing elsewhere is coming back to the United States, and that's kind of worrying since that tends to be a bellwether for the economy. And also, you know, some worrying potential, I guess, for the president there, because that's the sector of the economy he's been trying to help.
So, Nila, let me give you the last word. We've got just about a minute left. What's your favorite hopeful economic indicator out there? What do you look at and say, you know what, it's going to be all right?
Consumer spending. When I look at the economy, especially this particular expansion, it all goes back to the consumer. We've seen, as was Anna noted, we've seen pretty good amount of softness in the manufacturing sector. Yeah. Some of that is tied to trade. A lot of that is tied to automation. We've also seen some weakness in business investment, despite, you know, record levels of growth in corporate earnings last year and the year before. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing those earnings translate, as one would expect, into investment and CapEx spending. We haven't seen infrastructure. We haven't seen the fiscal side pick up in terms of infrastructure spending. But what has been consistent for 10 years plus is the consumer and consumer spending. And we're seeing savings rate strong, debt manageable, and the consumer still in good shape.
One hates to end on a downer, Nila, and I'm only going to give you 15 seconds to do this, but consumers have been carrying this economy for 10 years. Are we not getting tired?
We would like a little help, to be frank, and we don't need any more tariffs either. Right. So that is something to watch. And the question is going forward, how much gas in the tank does the consumer have to keep lifting the economy? That's what we're all super focused on.
Nila Richardson at Edward Jones and Anna Swanson at The New York Times. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend, would you?
Thank you, Kai.
Thank you. Have a great
on
weekend.
Wall Street on this Friday. Sorry, Anna, stepped on you there a little bit. Wall Street this Friday, you'd have thought, with Jay Powell giving a pretty comforting speech, as I talked about, and the jobs report being not too doggone bad, traders would have been in a better mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to dig into this morning's jobs report a little bit deeper here for just a second, because context, as we are fond of saying on this particular program, is everything. Nila and Anna and I went over most of the headline goods and bads of that jobs report. Wages good, slowing job growth, not good mostly. Also good is that more people are deciding to look for work, and a lot of those people are finding jobs. Turns out, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, August was the best month for people getting to work since the Great Recession.
We're seeing something in this month's jobs report that has been a long time coming. Through the Great Recession and slow, long recovery,
a growth in people who we never thought were going to enter the labor force, enter the labor force.
That's economist Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union. He's talking about something called the prime age employment to population ratio. It's the percentage of 25 to 54-year-olds, people in their most productive working years, who have a job. And it just hit 80%. Hasn't been that high since January 2008. And Adam Ozimek at Upwork thinks there's still room for improvement.
We think it should be able to do, you know, 81.5%.
That would be as good as the year 2000, the best economy for workers in decades. Women's participation in the labor force just surged to its highest level since 2002. Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter thinks one reason is that the tight labor market's drawing more parents back in.
People who were outside the labor force to care for children are facing lower barriers to reentry.
Amy Glazer at staffing firm Adecco says employers are offering more flexible schedules and work arrangements.
We literally have seen in the last 3 months a large spike in a lot of our call center clients offering work from home opportunities.
The danger is if job creation keeps slowing, there may not be enough jobs for all these would-be workers coming off the sidelines. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's pull on that jobs thread then with this observation. In an economy with 3.7% unemployment, a lot of us do have jobs, yes, but where are we working, big conglomerates or smaller shops? I ask because there are some signs things aren't going so well for smaller businesses and startups in this economy. New companies that have actual employees and payroll to meet are starting up more slowly than they did before the recession. That's according to data from the Census Bureau that the Associated Press dug out. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports that entrepreneurship seems to be getting harder.
Here's the data. Applications for new businesses likely to hire workers and have payroll are 16% lower than 12 years ago. One reason? Stingy credit, says business professor James Angel at Georgetown. He says new rules for banks after the Great Recession define small business loans as riskier.
Unless you have a wealthy friend who's willing to front you some cash, you need to find somebody who's going to lend you some money. But we've made it much more expensive for banks to lend money to small businesses.
The number of startups that hire people has actually been falling for four decades, says Jerry Davis at the University of Michigan School of Business. Nowadays, it's easier for startups to avoid hiring people full-time, he says. They can just pay people one gig at a time.
If you can rent the parts of a business, use temps rather than full-time employees, rent a factory, then you can look a lot more like a virtual startup, that you don't really need to create an enterprise with employees.
Which raises an issue of economic mobility. Small businesses do most of the country's hiring, so for many workers, they're the first rung on the economic ladder. And a bigger share of startups is now formed by historically disadvantaged groups, says Joyce Klein at the Aspen Institute.
Increasingly, our pie of entrepreneurs is more likely to be constituted people of color and women, and they have greater barriers in growing their business. That may be a trend that we're seeing here in the census data.
New businesses are critical to economic growth, says James Angel at Georgetown. They're not just where the hiring is, they're where the innovation is as well. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Whether a recession's coming or not is one of those known unknowns, right? I mean, one is definitely coming, we just don't know when. And when people hear the R word, a lot of things probably go through their minds. How much savings they have, what the stock market might do, and whether they are going to keep their jobs. We asked you the other day to tell us what recession makes you think of. Here are the jobs responses.
My name is C, and I'm calling from Michigan. I work at a small college, and I really love my job. When the recession words started to be tossed around, my immediate thought was that it was a good thing that I love my job because I'm going to be doing it for a lot longer than I thought I was going to be doing. I don't mind continuing to work, and I think I'm going to be like a much less boring Professor Binns, the history teacher in the Harry Potter novels, and just keep teaching after I'm gone.
Hello, my name is Connor Giard, and I'm the general manager of a craft beer distributor based in Burlington, Vermont. I started in this business in 2007, and even through the Great Recession and the recovery period, I've never really known anything other than explosive growth. Turns out when times are good, people will drink beer, and when times are bad, people will still drink beer.
Vinay Kumar from Phoenix, Arizona. I'm a mechanical engineer working for a brewing industry right now. So I believe markets are more responsive and more positive towards innovation and newer ideas right after a recession. Right now, I have something more than an idea. And if I'm able to get everything together by the time the next recession hits, I think I should be in a position to become an entrepreneur providing solutions at a lower cost.
My name is Saeed Sanchez from Chicago, Illinois. I own two businesses. One is a cleaning and maintenance company, and the other one is a business where I sell street clothing and sneakers, and both of them I might lose a couple clients because it's more of a luxury if it's not an emergency or necessity. And I know that 2008 recession is not going to be the same as this one, but I'll never forget it.
There is, of course, more to the R word than just jobs. Let us know what you're thinking about when you hear it. Marketplace.org is the place you can do. Coming up,
Frankenberry, Booberry, Fruit Brute, and Yummy Mummy.
Cereal and Sunday morning cartoons, just like when you were a kid. Except you're not. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial, 69 points to the good today, 0.2%, closed at 26,797, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 13 points, about 0.1%, 81.3. The S&P 500 up just 2 points, pretty much flat percentage-wise, 29.78. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added nearly 1.5%. The NASDAQ climbed 1.7%. The S&P 500 did the same 1.7% there. The CDC warned today that Americans should not use e-cigarettes. Go figure. Shares of cigarette company Altria were flat. Philip Morris grew 1.4%. Shares of British American Tobacco climbed 0.9%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell. 1.56% the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you owe on a mortgage in this economy, or have ever owed, or are planning to owe on a mortgage, then this next item is going to be of interest to you. As we mentioned the other day that it was about to do, the Trump administration has come out with a plan to set the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac loose again. Between them, the pair touches more than half of the mortgages in the United States. Marketplace's Amy Scott covers housing for us. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so this is, like, by definition, a ginormously complicated plan, unwinding or whatever the Trump administration wants to do. Give me the highlights, would you?
Yeah, the report calls it the last unfinished business of the financial crisis because it's been 11 years today, actually, since Fannie and Freddie were seized by the federal government during the financial crisis. So the report lays out four main goals. One is get these companies out of conservatorship, basically out of government control. Open the market to more competition from private companies. Get Fannie and Freddie on sound financial footing so they don't pose a big risk to taxpayers or the financial system. You know, another bailout isn't necessary. And then compensate the government for any support it gives to the market. And so this plan is basically a proposal, or actually 49 proposals for how to get there.
Is it going to work? And how's it going to work while at the same time maintaining access to mortgages, which is what these things were all about to begin with?
That's right. That's why they exist, to keep the market moving. One analyst I talked to said this plan is long on hope, short on details. There are a lot of assumptions. Basically, it's a lot of recommendations, many of which only Congress can do. And the things that the Trump administration can do are tough. One of the big issues is how to recapitalize Fannie and Freddie, which means basically for a long time they've been handing over most of their profits to the U.S. Treasury. But in order to be released into the wild, they have to have enough capital to protect them from future losses. One way to do that is stop giving Treasury all their profits, so gradually build up capital. But that's even that is not going to be enough money. So they're going to have to sell shares to private investors or on the public market. The problem is, with an election coming up, investors are going to be pretty reluctant to pour money into these companies, not knowing what might change if there's, for example, a new administration, new rules.
Well, so
ultimately, Congress needs to step in. And as we know, that's pretty unlikely.
All right. So speaking of different administrations, this is not the first time this has been tried. The Obama administration tried to do it. As you said, this is the last holdover from the financial crisis. Henry Paulson and his bazooka is what got us here. Why is this so hard?
Yeah, well, there is a huge disagreement, largely partisan, about how these companies should operate and how much the government should be involved. On the conservative side, people want less government control, more competition in the housing market. On the progressive side, there's a lot of concern about the affordable housing mandate. These companies are supposed to provide mortgages to people who may not otherwise get them. And they say that the plan really undercuts those goals. Also, housing is super important. I mean, it's about 15 to 18% of the economy. We've seen what happens when things go south. So people have been really worried about messing it up, frankly.
It's a little fraud. Amy Scott covers housing for us. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Adulting can be hard. You know, there's work and responsibility and family and kids and mortgages and rent and 1,001 other things that when you were a kid, you didn't have to deal with. A bit of nostalgia for days gone by? Sure. Also, a business opportunity. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that story.
Generations of American kids have grown up with the ritual of Saturday morning cartoons. You'd wake up before your parents, sneak to the kitchen, pour yourself a big old bowl of cereal, and plop down in front of the TV. For a couple of blissful hours, it was just you and your four favorite reptiles. On a recent Saturday morning, close to 100 adults tried to get that feeling back. They gathered in a movie theater in Brooklyn for a recurring event called Spoons, Tunes, and Booze. For $18, you get to eat as much sugary cereal as you want, watch cartoons, and have some grown-up beverages. 33-year-old James Ramirez wore a t-shirt featuring all the cereal box monsters. Count Chocula,
Frankenberry, Booberry, Fruit Brute, and Yummy Mummy.
He's a regular at Spoons, Tunes, and Booze. He works as a dispatcher for a corporate car service.
I just take rich people's calls all day, and I have to take their demands seriously, even though sometimes it sounds like they're panicking over nothing. So this is an escape just to get away from it.
People are willing to pay good money for this kind of escape, like $350 for a cake smash photo shoot, the kind parents do for their one-year-olds. You'll find hundreds of these on Instagram. A woman in a tutu and a crown sits next to a chalkboard that says, "Ashley, 384 months old. I love wine and shopping. I hate adulting." And then she smashes her face into a cake. Jess Summers, a photographer in Ohio, shoots about 10 of these a year.
You have to let go of all of your inhibitions of getting dirty or messy or sticky, and you just really have to just dig in on that cake.
Summers did a cake smash when she turned 30. She also likes to wear rainbow eyeshadow and dresses with fun patterns like dinosaurs. The inner child industry isn't just a millennial thing. Baby boomers have hung on to their old train sets and baseball cards. And 90-year-olds are doing cake smashes. Doug Stevens is CEO of the retail consulting firm Retail Profit. He says this is popular now because of where we are as a society.
We have trade wars happening. We are in the midst of a climate crisis. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty.
Stevens says it's only natural that people would want to retreat to a safe place.
And for many of us, that safe place is our childhood. And companies are only too happy to accommodate if there's money to be made in doing so.
But sometimes there's no company involved at all. Every summer, 33-year-old Abby Watson, her husband, and a couple dozen friends set up their own summer camp on the Chesapeake Bay. The property has spotty cell service, so they have to spend some time off the grid. They swim, play wiffle ball, hand out merit badges. One of them is for checking in with the office. At night, they make s'mores and hold talent shows.
It's basically a week of spending your life in a wet bathing suit, smelling like campfire, and just kind of running around with your pack of friends like you did as a kid.
Watson and her husband started the camp a few years ago when she and a lot of their friends worked in the Obama administration.
You can remember when you were a kid in the summer and you'd run around with this pack of friends and just like that sense of like closeness and belonging and that, you know, nothing was off limits in a way that like we don't really get to do as adults.
Camp also helps them get back in touch with the creativity, the sense of play that came so naturally when they were kids. But then it ends, and they go back to Washington and to adulthood. at least until next summer. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
You want to see those Cake Smash videos, right? Come on, you know you do. Or maybe pay a visit to that grown-up summer camp? Check out Marielle's story online. Marketplace.org is where you do that. This final note on the way out today. You remember we did an interview a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, about White Claw, the hard seltzer brand that's going great guns? Well, correlation is not causation, I know, but there was news today that White Claw has gotten so popular that there is now a nationwide shortage of the stuff. We are working round the clock to increase supply, the company said. Just drink beer, the radio guy said. Responsibly, of course. All right, that's all we got. Dow Industrial 69 points higher today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 13 points, about 0.1%. S&P 500 will basically call that flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.